Just get drunk tonight. He noticed that rye whiskey was $4 a bottle. In Buffalo, it cost 10, if you could get it at all. In New York City, 15 or 20. He knew because he had been trying to buy illicit liquor for the nightclubs. He returned to the hotel and got some ice. His room was dusty, with faded furniture and a view of the backyards behind a row of cheap stores. As the early northern night fell outside, he felt more depressed than ever in his whole life. He thought of going out and picking up a girl, but he did not have the heart for it. Was he going to flee from every place he ever lived? He had quit Petrograd because of a dead policeman. He had left Aberowen, literally one step ahead of people he had cheated at cards. Now he had fled Buffalo, a fugitive. He needed to do something about the Packard. The Buffalo police might cable a description to Toronto. He should either change the plates or change the car. But he could not summon the energy. Olga was probably glad to get rid of him. She would have her inheritance all to herself. However, the Vyalov empire was worth less and less every day. He wondered if he could bring Marga and baby Gregory to Canada. Would Marga even want to come? America was her dream, as it had been Lev's. Canada was not the fantasy destination of nightclub singers. She might follow Lev to New York or California, but not to Toronto. He was going to miss his children. Tears came to his eyes as he thought of Daisy growing up without him. She was not quite 4. She might forget him altogether. At best, she would have a vague recollection. She would not remember the largest sandwich in the world. After the third drink, it struck him that he was a pitiable victim of injustice. He had not meant to kill his father-in-law. Joseph had struck first. Anyway, Lev had not actually killed him. He had died of some kind of seizure or heart attack. It was really just bad luck, but no one was going to believe that. Olga was the only witness, and she would want revenge. He poured another vodka and lay on the bed. To hell with them all, he thought. As he drifted into a restless alcoholic sleep, he thought of the bottles in the shop window. Canadian Club, $4, read the sign. There was something important about that, he knew, but for the moment he could not put his finger on it. When he woke up next morning, his mouth was dry and his head ached, but he knew that Canadian Club at $4 a bottle could be his salvation. He rinsed his whiskey glass and drank the melted ice at the bottom of the pail. By his third glassful, he had a plan. Orange juice, coffee, and aspirins made him feel better. He thought about the dangers ahead, but he had never allowed himself to be deterred by risks. If I did that, he thought, I'd be my brother. There was one great drawback to his scheme. It depended on reconciliation with Olga. He drove to a low-rent neighborhood and went into a cheap restaurant that was serving breakfast to working men. He sat at a table with a group of what looked like house painters and said, I need to trade my car for a truck. Do you know anyone who might be interested? One of the men said, Is it legitimate? Lev gave his charming grin. Give me a break, buddy, he said. If it was legit, would I be selling it here? He found no takers there or at the next few places he tried, but eventually he ended up at an automobile repair shop, run by a father and son. He exchanged the Packard for a 2-ton Mack Junior van with 2 spare wheels, in a no-cash, no-papers deal. He knew he was being robbed, but the garage men knew he was desperate. Late that afternoon he went to a liquor wholesaler, whose address he had found in the city directory. I want 100 cases of Canadian Club, he said. What's your price? For that quantity, $36 a case. It's a deal. Lev took out his money. I'm opening a tavern outside of town and no need to explain, pal, said the wholesaler. He pointed out of the window. On the neighboring vacant lot, a team of building laborers were breaking ground. My new warehouse, 5 times the size of this one. Thank God for prohibition. Lev realized he was not the first person to have this bright idea. He paid the man and they loaded the whiskey into the Mack van. Next day, Lev drove back to Buffalo. 3. Lev parked the van full of whiskey on the street outside the Vyalov house. The winter afternoon was turning to dusk. There were no cars on the driveway. He waited a while, tense, expectant, ready to flee, but he saw no activity. His nerves stretched taut. He got out of the van, walked up to the front door, and let himself in with his own key. The place was hushed. From upstairs he could hear Daisy's voice and the murmured replies of Paulina. There was no other sound. Moving quietly on the thick carpet, he crossed the hall and looked into the drawing room. All the chairs had been pushed to the sides of the room. In the middle was a stand draped in black silk bearing a polished mahogany coffin with gleaming brass handles. In the casket was the corpse of Joseph Vyalov. Death had softened the pugnacious lines of the face, and he looked harmless. Olga sat alone beside the body. She wore a black dress. Her back was to the door. Lev stepped into the room. "Hello, Olga," he said quietly. She opened her mouth to scream, but he put his hand over her face and stopped her. "Nothing to worry about," Lev said. "I just want to talk." Slowly, he eased his grip. She did not scream. He relaxed a little. He was over the first hurdle. "You killed my father," she said angrily. "What could there be to talk about?" He took a deep breath. He had to handle this exactly right. Mere charm would not be enough. It would take brains, too. "The future," he said. He spoke in a low, intimate tone. "Yours, mine, and little Daisy's. I'm in trouble, I know. But so are you." She did not want to listen. "I'm not in any trouble." She turned away and looked at the body. Lev pulled up a chair and sat close to her. "The business you've inherited is shot. It's falling apart, almost worthless." "My father was very wealthy," she said indignantly. "He owned bars, hotels, and a liquor wholesaling business. They're all losing money, and prohibition has been in force only 2 weeks. He's already closed 5 bars. Soon there will be nothing left." Lev hesitated, then used the strongest argument he had. "You can't just consider yourself. You have to think about how you're going to raise Daisy." She stood, shaken. "Is the business really going bust? You heard what your father said to me at breakfast the day before yesterday. I don't really remember." "Well, don't take my word for anything, please. Check it out. Ask Norman Niall, the accountant. Ask anyone." She gave him a hard look and decided to take him seriously. "Why have you come to tell me this?" "Because I figured out how to save the business." "How?" "By importing liquor from Canada. It's against the law." "Yes, but it's your only hope. Without booze, you have no business." She tossed her head. "I can look after myself." "Sure," he said. "You can sell this house for a good sum, invest the proceeds, and move into a little apartment with your mother. Probably you could salvage enough from the estate to keep yourself and Daisy alive for a few years, though you should consider going out to work." "I can't work," she said. "I've never trained for anything. What would I do?" "Oh, listen, you could be a sales girl in a department store. You could work in a factory." He was not serious, and she knew it. "Don't be ridiculous," she snapped. "Then there's only one option." He reached out to touch her. She flinched away. "Why do you care what happens to me? You're my wife." She gave him a strange look. He put on his most sincere face. "I know I've mistreated you, but we loved each other once." She made a scornful noise in her throat. "And we have a daughter to worry about. But you're going to jail, unless you tell the truth." "What do you mean?" "Olga, you saw what happened. Your father attacked me. Look at my face. I have a black eye to prove it. I had to fight back. He must have had a weak heart. He may have been ill for some time. It would explain why he failed to prepare the business for prohibition. Anyway, he was killed by the effort of attacking me, not by the few blows I struck in self-defense. All you have to do is tell the police the truth. I've already told them you killed him." Lev was heartened. He was making progress. "That's all right," he reassured her. "You made a statement in the heat of the moment when you were stricken with grief. Now that you're calmer, you realize that your father's death was a terrible accident brought on by his bad health and his angry tantrum." "Will they believe me?" "A jury will. But if I hire a good lawyer, there won't even be a trial. How could there be, if the only witness swears it wasn't murder?" "I don't know." She changed tack. "How are you going to get the liquor?"
"Easy. Don't worry about it."
She turned in her chair to face him directly.
"I don't believe you. You're saying all this just to make me change my story. Put your coat on and I'll show you something."
It was a tense moment. If she went with him, she was his. After a pause, she stood up. Lev hid a triumphant smile. They left the room. Outside on the street, he opened the rear doors of the van. She was silent for a long moment. Then she said,
"Canadian Club."
Her tone had changed, he noted. It was practical. The emotion had faded into the background.
"100 cases, he said. "I bought it for $3 a bottle. I can get 10 here, more if we sell it by the shot. I have to think about this."
That was a good sign. She was ready to agree, but did not want to rush into anything.
"I understand. But there's no time, he said. I'm a wanted man with a truckload of illegal whiskey, and I have to have your decision right away. I'm sorry to hassle you, but you can see I have no choice.
She nodded thoughtfully, but did not say anything.
Lev went on. If you turn me down, I'll sell my booze, take a profit, and disappear. You'll be on your own then. I'll wish you luck and say goodbye forever, with no hard feelings. I would understand.
And if I say yes, we'll go to the police right away.
There was a long silence. At last, she nodded.
All right.
Lev looked away to hide his face.
You did it, he said to himself. You sat with her in the same room as her father's dead body, and you won her back. You dog.
4. I have to put on a hat, said Olga, and you need a clean shirt. We want to make a favorable impression. That was good. She was really on his side. They went back into the house and got ready. While he was waiting for her, he called the Buffalo Advertiser and asked for Peter Hoyle, the editor. The secretary asked him his business. Tell him I'm the man who's wanted for the murder of Joseph Vyolov. A moment later, a voice barked, Hoyle here.
Who are you?
Lev Peshkov, Vyolov's son-in-law.
Where are you?
Lev ignored the question. If you can have a reporter on the steps of police headquarters in half an hour, I'll have a statement for you.
We'll be there.
Mr. Hoyle?
Yes?
Send a photographer too. Lev hung up. With Olga beside him in the open front of the van, he drove first to Joseph's waterfront warehouse. Boxes of stolen cigarettes were stacked around the walls. In the office at the back, they found Vyalov's accountant, Norman Nile, plus the usual group of thugs. Norman was crooked but pernickety, Lev knew. He was sitting in Joseph's chair behind Joseph's desk. They were all astonished to see Lev and Olga. Lev said, Olga has inherited the business. I'll be running things from now on. Norman did not get up out of his chair.
We'll see about that, he said.
Lev gave him a hard stare and said nothing. Norman spoke again with less assurance.
The will has to be proved and so on.
Lev shook his head. If we wait for the formalities, there will be no business left. He pointed at one of the goons. Ilya, go out in the yard, look in the van, come back here and tell Norman what you see. Ilya went out. Lev moved around the desk to stand next to Norman. They waited in silence until Ilya came back.
100 cases of Canadian Club.
He put a bottle on the table.
We can try it. See if it's the real thing.
Lev said, I'm going to run the business with booze imported from Canada. Prohibition is the greatest business opportunity ever. People will pay anything for liquor. We're going to make a fortune. Get out of that chair, Norm.
I don't think so, kid, said Norman.
Lev pulled his gun fast and pistol-whipped Norman on both sides of the face. Norman cried out. Lev held the Colt casually pointed in the direction of the thugs. To her credit, Olga did not scream.
You asshole, Lev said to Norman. I killed Joseph Vyalov. Do you think I'm scared of a fucking accountant?
Norman got up and scurried out of the room, holding a hand to his bleeding mouth. Lev turned to the other men, still holding the pistol, pointing in their general direction, and said, Anyone else who doesn't want to work for me can leave now, and no hard feelings. No one moved.
Good, said Lev, because I was lying about no hard feelings.
He pointed at Ilya. You come with me and Mrs. Peshkov. You can drive. The rest of you, unload the van. Ilya drove them downtown in the Blue Hudson. Lev felt he might have made a mistake back there. He should not have said, I killed Joseph Vyalov in front of Olga. She could yet change her mind. If she mentioned it, he decided he would say he didn't mean it, but just said it to scare Norm. However, Olga did not raise the matter. Outside police headquarters, two men in overcoats and hats were waiting beside a big camera on a tripod. Lev and Olga got out of the car. Lev said to the reporter, The death of Joseph Vyalov is a tragedy for us, his family, and for this city. The man scribbled shorthand in a notebook. I have come to give the police my account of what happened. My wife Olga, the only other person present when he collapsed, is here to testify that I am innocent. The post-mortem will show that my father-in-law died of a heart attack. My wife and I plan to continue to expand the great business Joseph Vyalov started here in Buffalo. Thank you.
Look at the camera, please, said the photographer.
Lev put his arm around Olga, pulled her close and looked at the camera. The reporter said, How did you get the shiner, Lev?
This,
he said, and pointed to his eye.
Oh, hell, that's another story.
He smiled his most charming grin, and the photographer's magnesium flare went off with a blinding flash. Chapter 40. February to December 1920. The Aldershot military detention barracks was a grim place, Billy thought, but it was better than Siberia. Aldershot was an army town 35 miles southwest of London. The prison was a modern building with galleries of cells on three floors around an atrium. It was brightly lit by a glazed roof that gave the place its nickname of the Glass House. With heat pipes and gas lighting, it was more comfortable than most of the places where Billy had slept during the past 4 years. All the same, he was miserable. The war had been over for more than a year, yet he was still in the army. Most of his friends were out, earning good wages and taking girls to the pictures. He still wore the uniform and saluted. He slept in an army bed, and he ate army food. He worked all day at weaving mats, which was the prison industry. Worst of all, he never saw a woman. Somewhere out there, Mildred was waiting for him, probably. Everyone had a tale to tell of a soldier who would come home to find that his wife or girlfriend had gone off with another man. He had no communication with Mildred or anyone else outside. Prisoners, or soldiers under sentence, as they were officially called, could normally send and receive letters, but Billy was a special case. Because he had been convicted of betraying army secrets in letters, his mail was confiscated by the authorities. This was part of the army's revenge. He no longer had any secrets to betray, of course. What was he going to tell his sister? The boiled potatoes are always undercooked. Did Mam and Da and Grandpa even know about the court-martial? The soldiers next of kin had to be informed, he thought, but he was not sure, and no one would answer his questions. Anyway, Tommy Griffiths would almost certainly have told them. He hoped Ethel had explained what he had really been doing. He received no visitors. He suspected his family did not even know that he was back from Russia. He would have liked to challenge the ban on his receiving mail, but he had no way of contacting a lawyer, and no money to pay one. His only consolation was a vague feeling that this could not go on indefinitely. His news of the outside world came from the papers. Fitz was back in London, making speeches urging more military aid for the whites in Russia. Billy wondered if that meant the Aberowan pals had come home. Fitz's speeches were doing no good. Ethel's hands-off Russia campaign had won support and been endorsed by the Labour Party. Despite colourful anti-Bolshevik speeches by the Minister for War, Winston Churchill, Britain had withdrawn its troops from Arctic Russia. In mid-November, the Reds had driven Admiral Kolchak out of Omsk. Everything Billy had said about the whites, and Ethel had repeated in her campaign, turned out to be correct. Everything Fitz and Churchill said was wrong. Yet Billy was in jail and Fitz was in the House of Lords. He had little in common with his fellow inmates. They were not political prisoners. Most had committed real crimes, theft and assault and murder. They were hard men, but so was Billy, and he was not afraid of them. They treated him with wary deference, apparently feeling that his offence was a cut above theirs. He talked to them amiably enough, but none of them had any interest in politics. They saw nothing wrong with the society that had imprisoned them. They were just determined to beat the system next time. During the half-hour lunch break, he read the newspaper. Most of the others could not read. One day he opened the Daily Herald to see a photograph of a familiar face. After a moment of bewilderment, he realized the picture was of him. He recalled when it had been taken. Mildred had dragged him to a photographer in Aldgate and had him snapped in his uniform. "Every night I'll touch it to my lips," she had said. He had often thought of that ambiguous promise while he was away from her. The headline said, "Why is Sergeant Williams in jail?" Billy read on with mounting excitement. "William Williams of the 8th Battalion, the Welsh Rifles, the Aberowan Pals, is serving 10 years in a military prison convicted of treason. Is this man a traitor? Did he betray his country, desert to the enemy, or run from battle? On the contrary, he fought bravely at the Somme and continued to serve in France for the next 2 years, winning promotion to sergeant." Billy was excited. "That's me," he thought, "in the papers, and they say I fought bravely." Then he was sent to Russia. "We are not at war with Russia. The British people do not necessarily approve of the Bolshevik regime, but we do not attack every regime of which we disapprove. The Bolsheviks present no threat to our country or our allies. Parliament has never agreed to military action against the government in Moscow. There is a serious question as to whether our mission there is not a breach of international law. Indeed, for some months, the British people were not told that their army was fighting in Russia. The government made misleading statements to the effect that troops there were only protecting our property, organizing orderly withdrawal, or on standby. The clear implication was that they were not in action against Red forces. That this was exposed as a lie is in no small measure thanks to William Williams.
Eh?
He said to no one in particular. Look at that, thanks to William Williams. The men at his table crowded around to look over his shoulder. His cellmate, a brute called Cyril Park, said, "That's a picture of you. What are you doing in the paper?" Billy read the rest of it aloud. His crime was to tell the truth in letters to his sister that were written in a simple code to evade censorship. The British people owe him a debt of gratitude. But his action displeased those in the army and in government who were responsible for secretly using British soldiers for their own political ends. Williams was court-martialed and sentenced to 10 years. He is not unique. A large number of servicemen who objected to being made part of the attempted counter-revolution were subjected to highly dubious trials in Russia and given scandalously long sentences. William Williams and others have been victimized by vengeful men in positions of power. This must be put right. Britain is a country of justice. That, after all, is what we fought for.
How about that? Said Billy.
They say I've been victimized by powerful men.
So have I, said Cyril Parks, who had raped a 14-year-old Belgian girl in a barn.
Suddenly the newspaper was snatched out of Billy's hands. He looked up to see the stupid face of Andrew Jenkins, one of the more unpleasant warders.
You may have friends in all fucking places, Williams, the man said, but in here you're just another fucking con, so get back to fucking work.
Right away, Mr. Jenkins, said Billy.
2. Fitz was outraged that summer of 1920 when a Russian trade delegation came to London and was welcomed by the Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, at No. 10 Downing Street. The Bolsheviks were still at war with the newly reconstituted country of Poland, and Fitz thought Britain should be siding with the Poles, but he found little support. London dockers went on strike rather than load ships with rifles for the Polish army, and the Trades Union Congress threatened a general strike if the British army intervened. Fitz reconciled himself to never taking possession of the late Prince Andrei's estates. His sons, Boy and Andrew, had lost their Russian birthright, and he had to accept that. However, he could not keep quiet when he learned what the Russians, Kamenev and Krasin, were up to as they went around Britain. Room 40 still existed, albeit in a different form, and British intelligence was intercepting and deciphering the telegrams the Russians were sending home. Lev Kamenev, the chairman of the Moscow Soviet, was shamelessly putting out revolutionary propaganda. Fitz was so incensed that he berated Lloyd George early in August at one of the last dinner parties of the London season. It was at Lord Silverman's house in Belgrave Square. The dinner was not as lavish as those Silverman had thrown before the war. There were fewer courses, with less food sent untasted back to the kitchen, and the table decoration was simpler. The food was served by maids instead of footmen. No one wanted to be a footman these days. Fitz guessed those extravagant Edwardian parties were gone for good. However, Silverman was still able to attract the most powerful men in the land to his house. Lloyd George asked Fitz about his sister, Maud. That was another topic that enraged Fitz. "I'm sorry to say that she has married a German and gone to live in Berlin," he said. He did not say that she had already given birth to her first child, a boy called Eric. "I heard that," said Lloyd George. "I just wondered how she was getting on. Delightful young woman." The Prime Minister's liking for delightful young women was well known, not to say notorious. "I'm afraid life in Germany is hard," said Fitz. Maud had written to him pleading for an allowance, but he had refused point blank. She had not asked his permission for the marriage, so how could she expect his support? "Hard," said Lloyd George. "So it should be, after what they've done. All the same, I'm sorry for her." "On another subject, Prime Minister," said Fitz, "this fellow Kamenev is a Jew Bolshevik. You ought to deport him." The Prime Minister was in a mellow mood, with a glass of champagne in his hand. "My dear Fitz," he said amiably, "the government is not very worried about Russian misinformation, which is crude and violent. Please don't underestimate the British working class. They know claptrap when they hear it. Believe me,
Kamenev's speeches are doing more to discredit Bolshevism than anything you or I could say. Fitz thought this was complacent rubbish. He's even given money to the Daily Herald. It is discourteous, I agree, for a foreign government to subsidize one of our newspapers. But, really, are we frightened of the Daily Herald? It's not as if we liberals and conservatives don't have papers of our own. But he is contacting the most hardline revolutionary groups in his country, maniacs dedicated to the overthrow of our entire way of life. The more the British get to know about Bolshevism, the less they will like it, you mark my words. It is formidable only when seen at a distance, through impenetrable mists. Bolshevism is almost a safeguard to British society, for it infects all classes with a horror of what may happen if the present organization of society is overturned. I just don't like it. Besides, Lloyd George went on, if we throw them out, we may have to explain how we know what they're up to, and the news that we're spying on them may inflame working-class opinion against us more effectively than all their turgid speeches. Fitz did not like being lectured on political realities, even by the Prime Minister, but he persisted with his argument because he felt so angry. But surely we don't have to trade with the Bolsheviks. If we refuse to do business with all those who use their embassies here for propaganda, we wouldn't have many trading partners left. Come, come, Fitz. We trade with cannibals in the Solomon Islands. Fitz was not sure that was true. The cannibals of the Solomon Islands did not have much to offer, after all. But he let it pass. Are we so badly off that we have to sell to these murderers? I fear we are. I have talked to a good many businessmen, and they have rather frightened me about the next 18 months. There are no orders coming in. Customers won't buy. We may be in for the worst period of unemployment that any of us have ever known, but the Russians want to buy, and they pay in gold. I would not take their gold. Ah, but Fitz, said Lloyd George, you have so much of your own. 3. There was a party in Wellington Row when Billy took his bride home to Aberowen. It was a summer Saturday, and for once there was no rain. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Billy and Mildred arrived at the station with Mildred's children, Billy's new stepdaughters, Enid and Lillian, aged 8 and 7. By then the miners had come up from the pit, taken their weekly baths, and put on their Sunday suits. Billy's parents were waiting at the station. They were older and seemed diminished, no longer dominating those around them. Da shook Billy's hand and said, I'm proud of you, son. You stood up to them just like I taught you to. Billy was glad, although he did not see himself as just another of Da's achievements in life. They had met Mildred once before, at Ethel's wedding. Da shook Mildred's hand, and Mam kissed her. Mildred said, It's lovely to see you again, Mrs. Williams. Should I call you Mam there? It was the best thing she could have said, and Mam was delighted. Billy felt sure Da would come to love her, provided she could keep from swearing. Persistent questions by MPs in the House of Commons, fed with information by Ethel, had forced the government to announce reduced sentences for a number of soldiers and sailors court-martialed in Russia for mutiny and other offences. Billy's prison term had been reduced to 1 year, and he had been released and demobilized. He had married Mildred as quickly as possible after that. Aberowen seemed strange to him. The place had not changed much, but his feelings were different. It was small and drab, and the mountains all around seemed like walls to keep the people in. He was no longer sure this was his home. As when he had put on his pre-war suit, he found that, even though it still fit, he no longer felt right in it. Nothing that happened here would change the world, he thought. They walked up the hill to Wellington Row to find the houses decorated with bunting, the Union Jack, the Welsh Dragon, and the Red Flag. A banner across the street said, Welcome home, Billy Twice. All the neighbours were out in the street. There were tables with jugs of beer and urns of tea, and plates loaded with pies, cakes, and sandwiches. When they saw Billy, they sang, We'll keep a welcome in the hillsides. It made Billy cry. He was handed a pint of beer. A crowd of admiring young men gathered around Mildred. To them she was an exotic creature, with her London clothes and her Cockney accent, and a hat with a huge brim that she had trimmed herself with silk flowers. Even when she was on her best behavior, she could not help saying risque things like, I had to get it off me chest, if you'll pardon the expression. Grandpa looked older, and could hardly stand up straight, but mentally he was still all right. He took charge of Enid and Lillian, producing sweets out of his waistcoat pockets, and showing them how he could make a penny disappear. Billy had to talk to all the bereaved families about his dead comrades, Joey Ponty, Prophet Jones, Spotty Llewellyn, and the others. He was reunited with Tommy Griffiths, whom he had last seen in Ufa, Russia. Tommy's father, Len, the atheist, was gaunt with cancer. Billy was going to start down the pit again on Monday, and the miners all wanted to explain to him the changes underground since he had left. New roads driven deeper into the workings, more electric lights, better safety precautions. Tommy stood on a chair and made a speech of welcome. Then Billy had to respond. "The war has changed us all," he said. "I remember when people used to say the rich were put on this earth by God to rule over us lesser people." That was greeted by scornful laughs. "Many men were cured of that delusion by fighting under the command of upper-class officers who should not have been put in charge of a Sunday school outing." The other veterans nodded knowingly. "The war was won by men like us. Ordinary men, uneducated, but not stupid." They agreed, saying, "Aye," and "Hear, hear." "We've got the vote now, and so have our women, though not all of them yet, as my sister Eth will tell you quick enough." There was a little cheer from the women at that. "This is our country, and we must take control of it, just as the Bolsheviks have taken over in Russia and the Social Democrats in Germany." The men cheered. "We've got a working-class party, the Labour Party, and we've got the numbers to put our party in government. Lloyd George pulled a fast one at the last election, but he won't get away with that again." Someone shouted, "No! So here's what I've come home for. Percival Jones's days as MP for Aberowan are almost over." There was a cheer. "I want to see a Labour man representing us in the House of Commons." Billy caught his father's eye. Dar's face was aglow. "Thank you for your wonderful welcome." He got down from the chair, and they clapped enthusiastically. "Nice speech, Billy," said Tommy Griffiths. "But who's going to be that Labour MP?" "I'll tell you what, Tommy boy," said Billy. "I'll give you three guesses."
4. The philosopher Bertrand Russell visited Russia that year and wrote a short book called The Practice and Theory of Bolshevism. In the Leckwith family, it almost caused a divorce. Russell came out strongly against the Bolsheviks. Worse, he did so from a left-wing perspective. Unlike conservative critics, he did not argue that the Russian people had no right to depose the Tsar, share out the lands of the nobility among the peasants, and run their own factories. On the contrary, he approved of all that. He attacked the Bolsheviks not for having the wrong ideals, but for having the right ideals and failing to live up to them. So his conclusions could not be dismissed out of hand as propaganda. Bernie read it first. He had a librarian's horror of marking books, but in this case he made an exception, defacing the pages with angry comments, underlining sentences and writing "rubbish" or "invalid argument" with a pencil in the margins. Ethel read it while nursing the baby, now just over a year old. She was named Mildred, but they always shortened it to Millie. The older Mildred had moved to Aberowan with Billy and was already pregnant with their first child. Ethel missed her, even though she was glad to have the use of the upstairs rooms in the house. Little Millie had curly hair and, already, a flirtatious twinkle in her eye that reminded everyone of Ethel. Ethel enjoyed the book. Russell was a witty writer. With aristocratic insouciance, he had asked for an interview with Lenin and had spent an hour with the great man. They had spoken English. Lenin had said that Lord Northcliffe was his best propagandist. The Daily Mail's horror stories about Russians despoiling the aristocracy might terrify the bourgeoisie, but they would have the opposite effect on the British working class, he thought. But Russell made it clear that the Bolsheviks were completely undemocratic. The dictatorship of the proletariat was a real dictatorship, he said, but the rulers were middle-class intellectuals such as Lenin and Trotsky, assisted only by such proletarians who agreed with their views. "I think this is very worrying," said Ethel, when she put the book down. "Bertrand Russell is an aristocrat," Bernie said angrily. "He's the third Earl. That doesn't make him wrong." Millie stopped sucking and went to sleep. Ethel stroked her soft cheek with a fingertip. "Russell is a socialist. His complaint is that the Bolsheviks are not implementing socialism." "How can he say such a thing? The nobility has been crushed, but so has the opposition press. A temporary necessity. How temporary? The Russian Revolution is 3 years old. You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs.
He says there are arbitrary arrests and executions, and the secret police are more powerful now than they were under the Tsar. But they act against counter-revolutionaries, not against socialists. Socialism means freedom, even for counter-revolutionaries. Now it doesn't. It does to me.
Their raised voices woke Millie. Sensing the anger in the room, she started to cry.
There, said Ethel resentfully. Now look what you've done.
5. When Grigori returned home from the Civil War, he joined Katerina, Vladimir, and Anna in their comfortable apartment within the government enclave in the old fort of the Kremlin. For his taste, it was too comfortable. The entire country was suffering shortages of food and fuel, but in the shops of the Kremlin there was plenty. The compound had 3 restaurants with French-trained chefs, and, to Grigori's dismay, the waiters clicked their heels to the Bolsheviks as they had to the old nobility. Katerina put the children in the nursery while she visited the hairdresser. In the evening, members of the Central Committee went to the opera in chauffeur-driven cars.
"I hope we are not becoming the new nobility," he said to Katerina in bed one night. She laughed scornfully. "If we are, where are my diamonds?
But you know, we do have banquets and travel first class on the railway and so on.
The aristocrats never did anything useful. You all work 12, 15, 18 hours a day. You can't be expected to scavenge on rubbish tips for bits of wood to burn for warmth as the poor do.
But then there's always an excuse for the elite to have their special privileges.
Come here," she said. "I'll give you a special privilege."
After they had made love, Grigori lay awake. Despite his misgivings, he could not help feeling a secret satisfaction at seeing his family so well off. Katerina had put on weight. When he first met her, she had been a voluptuous 20-year-old girl. Now she was a plump mother of 26. Vladimir was 5 and learning to read and write in school with the other children of Russia's new rulers. Anna, usually called Anya, was a mischievous curly-headed 3-year-old. Their home had formerly belonged to one of the Tsaritsa's ladies-in-waiting. It was warm, dry, and spacious, with a second bedroom for the children, and a kitchen and living room, too. Enough accommodation for 20 people in Grigori's old lodgings in Petrograd. There were curtains at the windows, china cups for tea, a rug in front of the fire, and an oil painting of Lake Baikal over the fireplace. Grigori eventually fell asleep, to be wakened at 6 in the morning by a banging on the door. He opened it to a poorly dressed, skeletally thin woman who looked familiar.
"I am sorry to bother you so early, Excellency," she said, using the old style of respectful address.
He recognized her as the wife of Konstantin.
"Magda," he said in astonishment. "You look so different. Come in. What's the matter? Are you living in Moscow now?" "Yes. We moved here, Excellency. Don't call me that, for God's sake. Where is Konstantin?" "In prison." "What? Why?" "As a counter-revolutionary."
"Impossible," said Grigori. "There must have been a terrible mistake."
"Yes, sir. Who arrested him?" "The Cheka, the secret police."
"Well, they work for us. I'll find out about this. I'll make inquiries immediately after breakfast."
"Please, Excellency, I beg you, do something now. They are going to shoot him in 1 hour."
"Hell," said Grigori. "Wait while I get dressed."
He put on his uniform. Although it had no badges of rank, it was of a much better quality than that of an ordinary soldier, and marked him clearly as a commander. A few minutes later, he and Magda left the Kremlin compound. It was snowing. They walked the short distance to Lubyanka Square. The Cheka headquarters was a huge Baroque building of yellow brick, formerly the office of an insurance company. The guard at the door saluted Grigori. He began shouting as soon as he entered the building.
"Who is in charge here? Bring me the duty officer this instant. I am Comrade Grigori Peshkov, member of the Bolshevik Central Committee. I wish to see the prisoner Konstantin Vorotzintsev immediately." "What are you waiting for? Get on with it!"
He had discovered that this was the quickest way to get things done, even though it reminded him horribly of the petulant behavior of a spoiled nobleman. The guards ran around in panic for a few minutes, then Grigori suffered a shock. The duty officer was brought to the entrance hall. Grigori knew him. It was Mikhail Pinsky. Grigori was horrified. Pinsky had been a bully and a brute in the Tsarist police. Was he now a bully and a brute for the revolution? Pinsky gave an oily smile.
"Comrade Peshkov," he said, "what an honor. You didn't say that when I knocked you down for pestering a poor peasant girl, Grigori said. How things have changed, comrade. For all of us. Why have you arrested Konstantin Vorotsintsev? Counter-revolutionary activities. That's ridiculous. He was chair of the Bolshevik discussion group at the Putilov Works in 1914. He was one of the first deputies to the Petrograd Soviet. He's more Bolshevik than I am.
Is that so? Said Pinsky, and there was the hint of a threat in his voice.
Grigori ignored it. Bring him to me.
Right away, comrade.
A few minutes later, Konstantin appeared. He was dirty and unshaven, and he smelled like a pigsty. Magda burst into tears and threw her arms around him.
I need to talk to the prisoner privately, Grigori said to Pinsky. Take us to your office.
Pinsky shook his head.
My humble room.
Don't argue, Grigori said. Your office. It was a way of emphasizing his power. He needed to keep Pinsky under his thumb. Pinsky led them to an upstairs room overlooking the inner courtyard. He hastily swept a knuckle duster off the desk into a drawer. Looking out of the window, Grigori saw that it was daybreak.
Wait outside, he said to Pinsky.
They sat down and Grigori said to Konstantin,
What the hell is going on? We came to Moscow when the government moved,
Konstantin explained.
I thought I would become a commissar, but it was a mistake. I have no political support here. So what have you been doing? I've gone back to ordinary work. I'm at the Todd factory, making engine parts, cogs and pistons and ball races. But why do the police imagine you're counter-revolutionary? The factory elects a deputy to the Moscow Soviet. One of the engineers announced he would be a Menshevik candidate. He held a meeting and I went to listen. There were only a dozen people there. I didn't speak. I left halfway through and I didn't vote for him. The Bolshevik candidate won, of course. But after the election, everyone who attended that Menshevik meeting was fired. Then last week, we were all arrested.
We can't do this,
Grigori said in despair.
Not even in the name of the revolution. We can't arrest workers for listening to a different point of view.
Konstantin looked at him strangely.
Have you been away? Somewhere?
Of course, said Grigori.
Fighting the counter-revolutionary armies. Then that's why you don't know what's going on.
You mean this has happened before?
Rishka, it happens every day.
I can't believe it, Magda said, and last night I received a message from a friend who is married to a policeman, saying Konstantin and the others were all to be shot at 8 o'clock this morning. Grigori looked at his army-issue wristwatch. It was almost 8.
Pinsky,
he shouted. The policeman came in. Stop this execution.
I fear it is too late, comrade.
You mean these men have already been shot?
Not quite.
Pinsky went to the window. Grigori did the same. Konstantin and Magda stood beside him. Down in the snow-covered courtyard, a firing squad had assembled in the clear early light. Opposite the soldiers, a dozen blindfolded men stood shivering in thin indoor clothes. A red flag flew above their heads. As Grigori looked, the soldiers raised their rifles. Grigori yelled,
Stop at once! Do not shoot!
But his voice was muffled by the window, and no one heard. A moment later there was a crash of gunfire. The condemned men fell to the ground. Grigori stared, aghast. Around the slumped bodies, bloodstains appeared on the snow, bright red, to match the flag flying above. Chapter 41 November 11th to 12th, 1923. Maud slept in the day and got up in the middle of the afternoon when Walter brought the children home from Sunday school. Eric was 3 and Heike was 2, and they looked so sweet in their best clothes that Maud thought her heart would burst with love. She had never known an emotion like this. Even her mad passion for Walter had not been so overwhelming. The children also made her feel desperately anxious. Would she be able to feed them and keep them warm and protect them from riot and revolution? She gave them hot bread and milk to warm them. Then she began to prepare for the evening. She and Walter were throwing a small family party to celebrate the 38th birthday of Walter's cousin, Robert von Ulrich. Robert had not been killed in the war, contrary to Walter's parents' fears, or were they hopes? Either way, Walter had not become the Graf von Ulrich. Robert had been held in a prisoner of war camp in Siberia. When the Bolsheviks had made peace with Austria, Robert and his wartime comrade, Jörg, had set out to walk, hitchhike, and ride freight trains home.
It had taken them a year, but they had made it, and when they returned, Walter had found them an apartment in Berlin. Maud put on her apron. In the tiny kitchen of her little house, she made a soup out of cabbage, stale bread, and turnips. She also baked a small cake, although she had to eke out her ingredients with more turnips. She had learned to cook, and much else besides. A kindly neighbor, an older woman, had taken pity on the bewildered aristocrat and taught her how to make a bed, iron a shirt, and clean a bathtub. It had all come as something of a shock. They lived in a middle-class townhouse. They had not been able to spend any money on it, nor could they afford the servants Maud had always been used to, and they had a lot of second-hand furniture that Maud secretly thought was dreadfully suburban. They had looked forward to better times, but in fact, things had got worse. Walter's career in the foreign ministry had been dead-ended by his marriage to an Englishwoman, and he would have moved on to something else, but in the economic chaos he was lucky to have any job at all. And Maud's early disaffections seemed petty now, 4 years of poverty later. There was patched upholstery where the children had torn it, broken windows covered with cardboard, and paintwork peeling everywhere. But Maud had no regrets. Any time she liked, she could kiss Walter, slide her tongue into his mouth, unbutton his trousers, and lie with him on the bed or the couch or even the floor, and that made up for everything else. Walter's parents came to the party bringing half a ham and 2 bottles of wine. Otto had lost his family estate, Zumwalt, which was now in Poland. His savings had been reduced to nothing by inflation. However, the large garden of his Berlin house produced potatoes, and he still had a lot of pre-war wine. "How did you manage to find ham?" Walter said incredulously. Such things could normally be bought only with American dollars.
"I traded it for a bottle of vintage champagne," said Otto.
The grandparents put the children to bed. Otto told them a folk tale. From what Maud could hear, it was about a queen who had her brother beheaded. She shuddered, but did not interfere. Afterward, Suzanne sang lullabies in a reedy voice, and the children went to sleep, apparently none the worse for their grandfather's bloodthirsty story. Robert and Jörg arrived, wearing identical red ties. Otto greeted them warmly. He seemed to have no idea of their relationship, apparently accepting that Jörg was simply Robert's flatmate. Indeed, that was how the men behaved when they were with older folk. Maud thought that Suzanne probably guessed the truth. Women were harder to fool. Fortunately, they were more accepting. Robert and Jörg could be very different in liberal company. At parties in their own home, they made no secret of their romantic love. Many of their friends were the same. Maud had been startled at first. She had never seen men kissing, admiring one another's outfits, and flirting like schoolgirls. But such behavior was no longer taboo, at least in Berlin, and Maud had read Proust's Sodome et Gomorrhe, which seemed to suggest that this kind of thing had always gone on. Tonight, however, Robert and Jörg were on their best behavior. Over dinner, everyone talked about what was happening in Bavaria. On Thursday, an association of paramilitary groups called the Kampfbund had declared a national revolution in a beer hall in Munich. Maud could hardly bear to read the news these days. Workers went on strike, so right-wing bully boys beat up the strikers. Housewives marched to protest against the shortage of provisions, and their protests turned into food riots. Everyone in Germany was angry about the Versailles Treaty, yet the Social Democratic government had accepted it in full. People believed reparations were crippling the economy, even though Germany had paid only a fraction of the amount, and obviously had no intention of trying to clear the total. The Munich beer hall putsch had everyone worked up. The war hero Erich Ludendorff was its most prominent supporter. So-called stormtroopers in their brown shirts and students from the officers' infantry school had seized control of key buildings. City councillors had been taken hostage and prominent Jews arrested. On Friday, the legitimate government had counterattacked. 4 policemen and 16 paramilitaries had been killed. Maud was not able to judge, from the news that had reached Berlin so far, whether the insurrection was over or not. If the extremists took control of Bavaria, would the whole country fall to them? It made Walter angry. "We have a democratically elected government," he said. "Why can't people let them get on with the job?"
"Our government has betrayed us," said his father.
"In your opinion, so what? In America, when the Republicans won the last election, the Democrats didn't riot.
The United States is not being subverted by Bolsheviks and Jews.
If you're worried about the Bolsheviks, tell people not to vote for them. And what is this obsession with Jews?
They are a pernicious influence. There are Jews in Britain. Father, don't you remember how Lord Rothschild in London tried his best to prevent the war? There are Jews in France, in Russia, in America. They're not conspiring to betray their governments. What makes you think ours are peculiarly evil? Most of them only want to earn enough to feed their families and send their children to school, just the same as everyone else.
Robert surprised Maud by speaking up.
I agree with Uncle Otto, he said. Democracy is enfeebling. Germany needs strong leadership. Jürg and I have joined the National Socialists.
Oh, Robert, for God's sake, said Walter disgustedly. How could you?
Maud stood up.
Would anyone like a piece of birthday cake? She said brightly.
2. Maud left the party at 9 to go to work.
Where's your uniform? Said her mother-in-law as she said goodbye.
Suzanne thought Maud was a night nurse for a wealthy old gentleman.
I keep it there and change when I arrive, Maud said.
In fact, she played the piano in a nightclub called Nachtleben. However, it was true that she kept her uniform at work. She had to earn money, and she had never been taught to do much except dress up and go to parties. She had had a small inheritance from her father, but she had converted it to marks when she moved to Germany, and now it was worthless. Fitz refused to give her money because he was still angry with her for marrying without his permission. Walter's salary at the Foreign Office was raised every month, but it never kept pace with inflation. In partial compensation, the rent they paid for their house was now negligible, and the landlord no longer bothered to collect it. But they had to buy food. Maud got to the club at 9:30. The place was newly furnished and decorated, and looked good, even with the lights up. Waiters were polishing glasses, the barman was chipping ice, and a blind man was tuning the piano. Maud changed into a low-cut evening dress and fake jewelry, and made up her face heavily with powder, eyeliner, and lipstick. She was at the piano when the place opened at 10. It rapidly filled up with men and women in evening clothes, dancing and smoking. They bought champagne cocktails and discreetly sniffed cocaine. Despite poverty and inflation, Berlin's nightlife was hot. Money was no problem to these people. Either they had income from abroad, or they had something better than money. Stocks of coal, a slaughterhouse, a tobacco warehouse, or, best of all, gold. Maud was part of an all-female band playing the new music called jazz. Fitz would have been horrified to see it, but she liked the job. She had always rebelled against the restrictions of her upbringing. Doing the same tunes every night could be tedious, but despite that, it released something repressed within her. She wiggled on her piano stool and batted her eyelashes at the customers. At midnight, she had a spot of her own, singing and playing songs made popular by Negro singers such as Alberta Hunter, which she learned from American discs played on a gramophone that belonged to Nachtleben's owner. She was billed as Mississippi Maud. Between numbers, a customer staggered up to the piano and said, "Play Downhearted Blues, will you?" She knew the song, a big hit for Bessie Smith. She started to play blues chords in E-flat. "I might," she said. "What's it worth?" He held out a billion-mark note. Maud laughed. "That won't buy you the first bar," she said. "Haven't you got any foreign currency?" He handed her a dollar bill. She took the money, stuffed it into her sleeve, and played Downhearted Blues. Maud was overjoyed to have a dollar, which was worth about a trillion marks. Nevertheless, she felt a little down, and her heart was really in the blues. It was quite an achievement for a woman of her background to have learnt to hustle tips, but the process was demeaning. After her spot, the same customer accosted her on her way back to her dressing room. He put his hand on her hip and said, "Would you like to have breakfast with me, sweetheart?" Most nights she was poured, although at 33 she was one of the oldest women there. Many were girls of 19 and 20. When this happened, the girls were not allowed to make a fuss. They were supposed to smile sweetly, remove the man's hand gently, and say, "Not tonight, sir." But this was not always sufficiently discouraging, and the other girls had taught Maud a more effective line. "I've got these tiny insects in my cunt hair," she said. "Do you think it's anything to worry about?" The man disappeared. Maud spoke German effortlessly after 4 years there, and working at the club she had learned all the vulgar words, too. The club closed at 4 in the morning. Maud took off her makeup and changed back into her street clothes. She went to the kitchen and begged some coffee beans.
A cook who liked her gave her a few in a twist of paper. The musicians were paid in cash every night. All the girls brought large bags in which to carry the bundles of banknotes. On the way out, Maud picked up a newspaper left behind by a customer. Walter would read it. They could not afford to buy papers. She left the club and went straight to the bakery. It was dangerous to hold on to money. By evening, your wages might not buy a loaf. Several women were already waiting outside the shop in the cold. At 5:30, the baker opened the door and chalked up his prices on a board. Today, a loaf of black bread was 127 billion marks. Maud bought 4 loaves. They would not eat it all today, but that did not matter. Stale bread could be used to thicken soup. Banknotes could not. She got home at 6. Later she would dress the children and take them to their grandparents' house for the day, so that she could sleep. Right now she had an hour or so with Walter. It was the best part of the day. She prepared breakfast and took a tray into the bedroom. "Look," she said, "new bread, coffee, and a dollar." "Clever girl." He kissed her. "What shall we buy?" He shivered in his pajamas. "We need coal." "No rush. We can keep it if you want. It will be worth just as much next week. If you're cold, I'll warm you." He grinned. "Come on, then." She took off her clothes and got into bed. They ate the bread, drank the coffee, and made love. Sex was still exciting, even though it did not take as long as it had when first they were together. Afterward, Walter read the newspaper she had brought home. "The revolution in Munich is over," he said. "For good." Walter shrugged. "They've caught the leader. It's Adolf Hitler." "The head of the party Robert joined?" "Yes. He's been charged with high treason. He's in jail." "Good," said Maud with relief. "Thank God that's over." Chapter 42. December 1923 to January 1924. Earl Fitzherbert got up on a platform outside Aberowen Town Hall at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the day before the general election. He wore formal morning dress and a top hat. There was a burst of cheering from the Conservatives at the front, but most of the crowd booed. Someone threw a crumpled newspaper, and Billy said, "None of that now, boys, let him speak." Low clouds darkened the winter afternoon, and the streetlights were already lit. It was raining, but there was a big crowd, 200 or 300 people, mostly miners in their caps, with a few bowler hats at the front and a scatter of women under umbrellas. At the edges of the crowd, children played on the wet cobblestones. Fitz was campaigning in support of the sitting MP, Percival Jones. He began to talk about tariffs. This was fine with Billy. Fitz could speak on this subject all day without touching the hearts of Aberowen people. In theory, it was the big election issue. The Conservatives proposed to end unemployment by raising the duty on imports to protect British manufacturers. This had united the Liberals in opposition, for their oldest ideology was free trade. Labour agreed that tariffs were not the answer, and proposed a programme of national work to employ the idle, together with extended years of education to prevent ever more youngsters coming into the overcrowded job market. But the real issue was who was to rule. "In order to encourage agricultural employment, the Conservative government will give a bounty of £1 per acre to every farmer, provided he is paying his labourers 30 shillings a week or more," said Fitz. Billy shook his head, amused and disgusted at the same time. Why give money to farmers? They were not starving. Unemployed factory workers were. Beside Billy, Dar said, "This sort of talk isn't going to win votes in Aberowen." Billy agreed. The constituency had once been dominated by hill farmers, but those days were over. Now that the working class had the vote, the miners would outnumber the farmers. Percival Jones had held on to his seat in the confused election of 1922 by a few votes. Surely this time he would be thrown out. Fitz was winding up. "If you vote Labour, you will be voting for a man whose army record is stained," he said. The audience did not much like that. They knew Billy's story and regarded him as a hero. There was a mutter of dissent, and Dar shouted, "Shame on you!" Fitz ploughed on. "A man who betrayed his comrades in arms and his officers. A man who was court-martialed for disloyalty and sent to jail. I say to you, do not bring disgrace on Aberowen by electing to Parliament a man such as that." Fitz got down to ragged applause and boos. Billy stared at him, but Fitz did not meet his eye. Billy climbed onto the platform in his turn.
You're probably expecting me to insult Lord Fitzherbert the way he insulted me, he said. In the crowd, Tommy Griffiths shouted, Give him hell, Billy! Billy said, But this isn't a pithead punch-up. This election is too important to be decided by cheap jibes. They became subdued. Billy knew they would not much like this reasonable approach. They enjoyed cheap jibes. But he saw his father nodding approval. Dar understood what Billy was trying to do. Of course he understood. He had taught Billy. The Earl has shown courage, coming here and stating his views to a crowd of coal miners, Billy went on. He may be wrong, he is wrong, but he's no coward. He was like that in the war. Many of our officers were. They were brave, but wrong-headed. They had the wrong strategy and the wrong tactics. Their communications were poor, and their thinking was out of date. But they wouldn't change their ideas until millions of men had been killed. The audience had gone quiet. They were interested now. Billy saw Mildred looking proud with a baby in each arm. Billy's two sons, David and Keir, aged 1 and 2. Mildred was not passionate about politics, but she wanted Billy to become an MP so that they could go back to London and she could restart her business. In the war, no working-class man was ever promoted above the rank of sergeant, and all public school boys entered the army as second lieutenants. Every veteran here today had his life needlessly put at risk by half-witted officers, and many of us had our lives saved by an intelligent sergeant. There was a loud murmur of agreement. I'm here to say those days are over. In the army and in other walks of life, men should be promoted for brains, not birth. He raised his voice and heard in his tone the thrill of passion that he knew from his father's sermons. This election is about the future and the kind of country our children will grow up in. We must make sure it's different from the one we grow up in. The Labour Party doesn't call for revolution. We've seen that in other countries and it doesn't work. But we do call for change. Serious change. Major change. Radical change. He paused, then raised his voice again for his peroration. No, I don't insult Lord Fitzherbert, nor Mr. Percival Jones, he said, pointing at the two top hats in the front row. I simply say to them, Gentlemen, you are history. There was a cheer. Billy looked over the front row to the crowd of miners. Strong, brave men who had been born with nothing, but had nevertheless made lives for themselves and their families. Fellow workers, he said, we are the future. He got down from the platform. When the votes were counted, he won by a landslide. 2. So did Ethel. The Conservatives formed the largest party in the new Parliament, but they did not have an overall majority. Labour came second, with 191 MPs, including F. Leckwith from Aldgate and Billy Williams from Aberowen. The Liberals were third. The Scottish Prohibitionists won one seat. The Communist Party got none. When the new Parliament assembled, Labour and Liberal members combined to vote the Conservative government out, and the King was obliged to ask the leader of the Labour Party, Ramsay MacDonald, to become Prime Minister. For the first time, Britain had a Labour government. Ethel had not been inside the Palace of Westminster since the day in 1916 when she got thrown out for shouting at Lloyd George. Now she sat on the green leather bench, in a new coat and hat, listening to the speeches, occasionally glancing up to the public gallery from which she had been ejected more than 7 years ago. She went into the lobby and voted with the members of the cabinet, famous socialists she had admired from a distance, Arthur Henderson, Philip Snowden, Sidney Webb, and the Prime Minister himself. She had her own desk in a little office shared with another female Labour MP. She browsed in the library, ate buttered toast in the tea room, and picked up sacks of mail addressed to her. She walked around the vast building, learning its geography, trying to feel she was entitled to be there. One day, at the end of January, she took Lloyd with her and showed him around. He was almost 9 years old, and he had never been inside a building so large or so luxurious. She tried to explain the principles of democracy to him, but he was a little young. On a narrow red-carpeted staircase on the border between the Commons and the Lords areas, they ran into Fitz. He, too, had a young guest. His son George, called Boy.
Ethel and Lloyd were going up, Fitz and Boy coming down, and they met on a half-landing. Fitz stared at her as if he expected her to give way. Fitz's two sons, Boy and Lloyd, the heir to the title and the unacknowledged bastard, were the same age. They looked at one another with frank interest. At Tŷ Gwyn, Ethel remembered, whenever she encountered Fitz in the corridor, she had had to stand aside, up against the wall, with her eyes cast down as he passed by. Now she stood in the middle of the landing, holding Lloyd's hand firmly, and stared at Fitz. "Good morning, Lord Fitzherbert," she said, and she tilted her chin up defiantly. He stared back. His face showed angry resentment. At last he said, "Good morning, Mrs. Leckwith." She looked at his son. "You must be Viscount Aberowen," she said. "How do you do?" "How do you do, ma'am?" the child said politely. She said to Fitz, "And this is my son, Lloyd." Fitz refused to look at him. Ethel was not going to let Fitz off lightly. She said, "Shake hands with the Earl, Lloyd." Lloyd stuck out his hand and said, "Pleased to meet you, Earl." It would have been undignified to snub a 9-year-old. Fitz was forced to shake. For the first time, he had touched his son, Lloyd. "And now we'll bid you good day," Ethel said dismissively, and she took a step forward. Fitz's expression was thunderous. Reluctantly, he stood aside with his son, and they waited, backs to the wall, as Ethel and Lloyd walked past them and on up the stairs. Historical characters. Several real historical characters appear in these pages, and readers sometimes ask how I draw the line between history and fiction. It's a fair question, and here's the answer. In some cases, for example, when Sir Edward Grey addresses the House of Commons, my fictional characters are witnessing an event that really happened. What Sir Edward says in this novel corresponds to the parliamentary record, except that I have shortened his speech, without, I hope, losing anything important. Sometimes a real person goes to a fictional location, as when Winston Churchill visits Tŷ Gwyn. In that case, I have made sure that it was not unusual for him to visit country houses, and that he could well have done so at around that date. When real people have conversations with my fictional characters, they are usually saying things they really did say at some point. Lloyd George's explanation to Fitz of why he does not want to deport Lev Kamenev is based on what Lloyd George wrote in a memo quoted in Peter Rowland's biography. My rule is, either the scene did happen, or it might have. Either these words were used, or they might have been. And if I find some reason why the scene could not have taken place in real life, or the words would not really have been said, if, for example, the character was in another country at the time, I leave it out. This is John Lee. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Fall of Giants by Ken Follett. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Janet Stark. Fall of Giants is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group, USA, Inc., and Books on Tape. Copyright 2010. All rights reserved. The book, Fall of Giants, is available wherever Dutton are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.